Welcome to Psydactic. I am Dr. O'Leary, a fourth-year psychiatry resident in the National Capital Region. This is a podcast about psychiatry and neuroscience. I make it in my free time, and I'm inspired to find out more about a particular topic. I try to speak the truth back to you, but be aware that I'm really often trying to draw intricate and precise pictures with a box of jumbo crayons. And today I will illustrate this perfectly. I'm going to try to draw a picture for you of the way the thalamus affects pretty much everything you sense, do, or even think about. The thalamus, or more accurately, the thalami, are bilaterally symmetrical structures in the subcortical part of the brain, and they're cradled by the basal ganglia. They're major hubs of pretty much everything your brain does, and all of the sensory information coming into your brain, with the exception of smell. More primitive models of the brain visualize it as a bunch of relatively isolated modules, each specialized to perform a single task when it's queried, and then able to send that information forward wherever it needs to go next. Sort of like sequential processing. But more modern ideas propose an integrated picture with various regions of the brain contributing to a more diffuse process through parallel connections with other network communities and other hubs in the brain. It appears that nearly every integrated process in the brain is influenced at some level by thalamic modulation. You could characterize the thalamus as a brain-wide gateway to the cortex, a modulator and mediator of inputs and outputs, a coordinator of feedback, a relay between higher cognitive errors, a manager of brainstem nuclei, and a facilitator of our attention. Visual, auditory, and the somatosensory information passes through the thalamus on its way up to the cortex. Information from one cortical area that needs to go to another often passes through the thalamus and might even be sent simultaneously to brainstem nuclei and in a parallel way to other parts of the cortex. So let's just imagine you're walking down the street and a Siamese cat leaps off the porch in front of you. It stops, stares directly at you, arches its back, bristles, and hisses at you. Now, you carefully walk a safe distance from it while keeping your eyes on it enough to know what it is doing so you could potentially respond. In your brain, there has to be a lot going on. You're receiving retinal information that's passing through the thalamus and being relayed to your visual cortex, which is feeding back to the thalamus and to other parts of the brain. You are at the same time moving in relationship to the cat and the other objects on the street around you, and you're turning your head while you're walking so as not to lose sight of this frisky feline. The fact that your head is turning needs to be understood by the neurons controlling your feet so that they don't keep walking in the same direction that your eyes are facing. The identity of the cat is also being processed, probably by your temporal lobes. Its intentions are being inferred, possibly by the medial part of your frontal lobes. Its threat value might be considered in things like your orbital frontal cortex and your amygdala. While the features of the environment, like the size of the environment, the distance of the cat from you, things like that, they're all being calculated in your parietal cortex. And this fed forward to other parts of your cortex, like your cingulate cortex and the premotor areas of your brain, while you plan your next move. Now, these motor areas have to constantly be aware of the sensory information in order to kind of infer what will happen next and plan an action that's responsive to the environment. Every swing of your arm, every blink of your eye. Cortical regions might be talking directly to other cortical regions through things like the uncinate fasciculus or the superior longitudinal fasciculi or things called short association fibers. But much of the information is being relayed through and integrated in the thalamus before going to other cortical regions. Or it's doing that at the same time that information is going between cortical regions through the long white matter tracts. Your cerebellum is also getting direct sensory information that has never passed through the thalamus, and association tracts are running back and forth between itself and the thalamus. All of this has to happen so that you can avoid a cat that might scratch your eyes out. The more I learn about things like the thalamus and the complex interplay of brain networks, the more I feel like it is impossible to have just a purely sensory experience. For example, whenever we hear a sound, it's not just a vibratory frequency, but at the same time in your brain, it's a preparatory act. It's an emotion. It's history. Some of us might experience some sounds as having a color. The thalamus is the meeting of the minds within our mind that gives depth to our experiences, to our sensory experiences, and to our plans for the future. They say that the expansion of our cortex, especially those frontal lobes, is what gave us our complex reasoning abilities. And this is true, but without the thalamus, the cortex would not even have a chance of being able to do what it can do. The thalamus receives and sends out primarily excitatory signals. It has its own population within it of GABAergic inhibitory neurons, especially in the thalamic reticular nucleus, and there are some interneurons within the thalamus as well. But those are local. They only work on thalamic networks. The thalamus does not send out any direct inhibitory neurons, and it doesn't receive from outside of the thalamic networks any inhibitory neurons. The connections in the thalamus are unique from those of the cortex, because in the cortex, they're kind of populations of neurons within different layers, and these layers work together kind of to ramp up activity in that part of a network. But thalamic networks can't really excite themselves. They can only receive excitatory signals from outside and then send excitatory signals forward. In the past, the thalamus has been described as having different nuclei or regions that each perform a single function, but more recently it's been demonstrated that each of these nuclei have really been co-opted to perform heterogeneous functions. But basically that means that they can do more than one thing with the same machinery. Now, I mentioned before that nerves that innervate and leave the thalamus are excitatory, they're glutamatergic. This means they dump glutamate on their targets. Some of these neurons contain very, very specific information, like when retinal neurons communicate a color through the thalamus, or they communicate the presence of light. Other of the neurons in the thalamus, just modulate activity. They're not sending a direct signal with very specific information in it, but they're modulating the activity of other signals being sent. So the information these carry are like whether or not the activity of the neurons in the thalamus should send a signal or not, or how much of a signal it should be sending. So modulatory signals end up making other neurons more excitable or not. If they synapse with a GABAergic interneuron, the GABAergic interneuron might tone down outputs from the thalamus. So what that means is just because the thalamus is sending or receiving glutamate does not mean that it is always resulting in a downstream excitatory activity. If glutamate from a signal exiting the thalamus is hitting, for example, a GABAergic PARV albumin, an interneuron in the cortex, this will result in inhibition of that particular cortical region. So to make things even more complex and beautiful at the same time, excitatory glutamatergic neurons from the thalamus also synapse on what are called vasoactive intestinal peptide-positive interneurons, and these are neurons that inhibit inhibitory neurons in the cortex. So this results in a disinhibition. Neurons from the thalamus are sending excitatory signals, which causes another neuron to inhibit another neuron, but the neuron that it's inhibiting is inhibiting another neuron. So in the end, it results in more excitatory activity getting through. I really love the complexity here. Remember that I said that the thalamus sends excitatory signals to the cortex or to other regions like the basal ganglia or to the brainstem. Some of the neurons in the thalamus actually split as they send out signals, and so they go to multiple regions at the same time. Some neurons within the thalamus are receiving signals from multiple regions at the same time and might be receiving input from both subcortical and cortical structures simultaneously. One cool relationship within the thalamus is called a triad. So this is a system where a glutamate-sending neuron synapses with another glutamate-sending neuron in the thalamus, but it also is synapsing at the same time with a GABAergic interneuron that itself is inhibiting the neuron that is being excited by that incoming GABAergic neuron. So at first, this might not seem to make a lot of sense. Why inhibit the thing that you are trying to excite at the same time? But a system like this can make sense, and in multiple ways, depending on how it's structured and how it works. For example, GABA-A receptors are ion channels, and they act like super fast to hyperpolarize cells on a neuron, and this reduces excitability really fast. GABA-B receptors are G-protein-coupled receptors that act through second messengers, and they cause changes in metabolism within the cell, and this is a relatively slow process. So you're talking about in the ion channels, like milliseconds, and then with a G-protein-coupled receptor, you're talking about maybe seconds to minutes. Glutamate receptors can be very diverse as well. They include ion channels like the NMDA and AMPA receptors, but they also include metabotropic receptors, those G-protein coupled receptors, some of which are inhibitory. So just because you're sending glutamate doesn't necessarily mean that it's exciting the cell, but it mostly is. Without getting in too much into the detail, it's important to know that like receptors like these have different effects on target cells, because of things like their location or their density, or very importantly, their relative affinity for the neurotransmitter. Some of them just have a much higher affinity than others, which means that that neurotransmitter is going to hit them first. So imagine a triad or three neuron system where glutamate's being dumped by an incoming neuron onto both an inhibitory and excitatory neuron. The inhibitory neuron inhibits the outgoing excitatory neuron. If the inhibitory neuron responds faster to the glutamate or has a higher average affinity for the glutamate, then it could put the brakes on a signal getting through. It's basically, you could say, decreasing the gain on the system. You could also say that it's increasing the amount of glutamate needed to send a signal, which would decrease the rate of false positive signals getting through, while at the same time potentially increasing the rate of false negative signals. Those are signals that should be getting through that aren't because that neuron is being inhibited. Now, once that GABAergic interneuron is functioning kind of at its full capacity and it can't do more, then adding more glutamate can only increase the excitability of the glutamatergic neuron and it will start to fire despite being inhibited because now it's receiving more signal. In a system like this, the energy required to send a signal could be increased or decreased pretty easily, and this could regulate the outputs from the system. One alternative way is kind of somewhat the opposite. Imagine that the excitatory neuron is receiving the glutamate from an incoming neuron, and it can respond faster and with a higher relative affinity for the glutamate than that inhibitory interneuron. In this system, a signal coming in would always immediately kind of be sent through. However, as that signal got stronger, a ceiling could be placed on the excitability of the downstream glutamatergic neuron by the inhibitory neuron because at some level, it will start to decrease the gain of the system. Basically, as the system gets louder, the more inhibition it will put in. So in this way, like the interneuron would kind of just be making sure that things don't get too out of control. A third way to view this is that the inhibitory interneuron might respond differentially, both to low levels of glutamate, but also to very high-level glutamate, but be relatively less able to inhibit its target neuron at intermediate levels. So in a system like this, an inhibitory neuron can set basically a floor and a ceiling. it can make the system wait until enough signal has gotten through, and it can also tone the system down if too much is going through. It's kind of like waiting until enough guests have arrived at the party before starting the party and then shutting the party down once it gets a little out of control. Now, I'm not saying that any of these mechanisms that I just speculated are the way that any particular triad in the thalamus works. I'm just saying that having a triad is a potentially powerful way to modulate neural signaling, and the thalamus is heavy with triads. Another cool aspect of how the thalamus communicates is that it often processes parallel streams of data about the same thing. So let's take signals coming from our retina, for example. I first remember kind of struggling with the idea that what I'm seeing is not really what's in front of me. Like I have no ability to actually access reality. It's just some vague attempt my brain is making to make sense of the photons that have hit my retina. The better the brain is at inferring what these mean, the better decisions it can make. But fundamentally, it's impossible to actually experience reality. The retina starts our journey toward approximating reality by sending out three different streams of visual information simultaneously. So let's call these W, X, and Y streams. In the end, the X and Y streams both synapse in the thalamus and end up in layer 4 of the primary visual cortex. However, in the thalamus, the X stream forms one of those triads I was talking about, while the Y stream has only a simple one-to-one synapse. Also, even though both end up in layer 4 of the primary visual cortex, the X stream terminates in a deeper section of layer 4 than the Y stream does. The Y stream also splits on its way to the visual cortex after exiting the thalamus and innervates layer 4 of the secondary visual cortex with the exact same information. So we have different streams of information about the same thing coming from the retina. One stream forms a triad in the thalamus and then heads on to layer 4 of the primary visual motor cortex, while the other forms only a simple synapse in the thalamus before going out to a different part of layer 4 in two separate parts of our visual cortex. But what happens to that W stream? So the W stream appears more heterogeneous, like the connections between it and other neurons are not necessarily predictable. The important aspect is that it shares its final information with layers 2 or 3 of the visual cortex, and also sometimes layer 1. Let me summarize that again. So when you look at something, it's first processed in your retinal ganglion cells, and then different populations of these cells send out at least 3 parallel streams of information about that thing, and these are processed in the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus via variable synaptic type relationships. And then it's sent forward to layers 1 through 4 of the primary visual cortex and also layer 4 of the secondary visual cortex. Before ever making it to the visual cortex, the information is processed at least twice, once in the retina and again in the thalamus. Would you be surprised now if I told you that this itself is probably an oversimplification? Without the thalamus, we couldn't have higher order thoughts. What that means is that we would not be able to think things about sensory information that we're receiving. And we certainly would not be able to think about the things that we are thinking. The thalamus has been kind of conceptualized as processing two kinds of information. First order processing is how the thalamus routes information that's coming from subcortical inputs like our senses. This is first order information. Higher order processes involve information that's being fed to the thalamus from cortical regions. Now, cortical regions send different kinds of information to the thalamus. The first kind is, you could call it direct feedback, right? This comes from layer 6. So this is feedback that the thalamus gets after sending a signal to that particular cortex. This is distinct from what has been called driver signaling. So driver signals are signals that create new streams of information in the thalamus instead of just modulating existing streams like feedback neurons do. driver signals, when they come from the cortex, come from layer 5 generally. Now remember, all the nuclei within the thalamus I mentioned earlier today, I didn't name them, but some of these are specialized in first order drivers and some in higher order drivers. When one cortical region wants to send information to another cortical region, the thalamus acts as a mediator. Layer 5 neurons send information to the thalamus, which processes it, and often in one of those triads, and then sends that forward to more shallow layers of a different part of the cortex, which will send feedback to the thalamus about that information from layer 6 of the cortex. That same driver signal from layer 5 or other signals with kind of complementary information might bypass the thalamus altogether as well on its way to, for example, another part of the cortex or to brainstem nuclei. So the same information is skipping the thalamus, but also going through the thalamus, and the targets of that information are being modified by what happens inside the thalamus. Our thalamus is not just a relay station. It's like its own little brain within our brain telling the rest of our brain what it should and shouldn't be doing, and is kind of like a gatekeeper. I encourage you to Google the thalamus and see what you can come up with. There's so much we don't understand. And I hope that without going into too much detail and trying to name every nucleus and name every kind of connection in the thalamus, this podcast will help you understand the kind of complexity that happens within the thalamus. Neuroscientists are trying to figure out the exact structure of all of these networks because you have to know the structure of the network in order to propose mechanisms by which they might work. And they're getting closer and closer and closer to these answers. It's very exciting. I hope to be able to, in the future, make some episodes about how the thalamus is integral in controlling things like our emotions and our affective state, and how it might function in people who are experiencing things like looseness of associations. Thank you for hanging out with me today and listening to me nerd out about the thalamus. I am Dr. O, and this has been an episode of Psydactic.